21. And it's possible we might wrap this up tonight. I'm not quite sure. Just all depends on how chatty you all are. You know how you guys get. But we closed off. Remember, Jesus is appearing to the apostles. And this is the third time that he has done so. We remember the first meeting without Thomas and then the second meeting with Thomas. Now, on this occasion, not all of the apostles are there, but he meets with seven of them in Galilee. Now, this is the place he told them where he was going to meet them. And so that's what's going on here in John chapter 21. If you weren't here last week, we suggested that really the main body of the book closes with chapter 20. And this is kind of an epilogue of the book. And it really has a lot to do, most scholars would say, with the relationship between Jesus and Peter. And he's sort of tying up loose ends or whatever here in the close of the book. And you'll be able to tell at the very end of the book, the last verse in the book, in chapter 21, basically ties back into the last verse or the verse before last of chapter 20, which kind of gives you that strong indication that that chapter 21 is indeed just an epilogue. And so we'll deal with that just a little bit as we close the epistle. But Peter and the other apostles have gone fishing, you remember. And Jesus appears to them on the shore, and I didn't make mention. It was brought to my attention. I think I had in my notes somewhere that it's very possible. It's not definitive, of course, but it's very possible that this was sort of a miraculous appearing of Jesus, that he just appeared there on the shore. Some scholars who are Greek scholars and know a lot more than me about that say that the wording of it indicates that. I can't verify that, but it does appear that he just appears. Now, there are 100 yards out in the Sea of Galilee, and it's dark. It's just the sun just coming up. They have fished all night long, and so it's still dim out. So they don't recognize Jesus at this point. And that's where we left off, about verse 6 or so, that he says to them, cast the net on the other side of the boat, and you will find some. And so they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. And so, obviously, again, there's some dispute over that. I think most will see that this is a miraculous situation again that's transpiring here. It puts you into mind, and we may go ahead and read it, but back in Luke chapter 5 of when Jesus did this same sort of thing for the apostles. They were out fishing, and they fished all night long, and again, they didn't catch anything on that occasion, and Jesus intervened and provided fish for them. And so as we read this, all of a sudden here, again, they don't recognize him, but it says at verse 8 that verse 7, that disciple whom Jesus loved, therefore said to Peter, it is the Lord, that being John. And so something got into the mind of John there. Again, they're way out. He still can't recognize Jesus from that distance and at that time. And so something triggered in John's mind that this is the Lord. And it's probably just the recollection of what had happened before in Luke chapter 5. Turn over there just for a minute, and we'll just read that. We won't spend a lot of time with it, but you've read this no doubt many times before. But at verse 1, it says, on one occasion, while the crowd was pressing in on him to hear the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, and he saw two boats by the lake, But the fishermen had gone out of them and were washing their nets, so they had failed to catch any fish. And getting into the boats, which was Simon's, he asked him to put out a little from the land. And he sat down and he taught the people from the boat. And when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, put out into the deep and let your nets let down your nets for a catch. And Simon answered, Master, we have toiled all night and took nothing, but at your word, I will let down the nets. And so you remember reading this before. A lot of good stuff in here that's very preachable here, but we'll not get bogged down on it right now. But he says, and when they had done this, they enclosed a large number of fish and their nets were breaking. So again, Jesus intervened and they catch a whole lot of fish, this time so much that the nets wouldn't hold. The nets were breaking. And so they signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and to help them. And they came and they filled both of the boats so that they began to sink. But when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord. For he and all who were with him were astonished at the catch of the fish and that they had taken. And so also were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, do not be afraid. From now on, you will be catchers of men. And so this is very much like what's going on in John chapter 21. Now, there's plenty of difference between these two situations. There have been some commentaries that have tried to equate these two events, which is that's just ridiculous. I mean, there's several. We could go down the line and point out the differences in Luke 5 and in John 21. But it is the same thing that's happening. They fish all night long and don't catch anything. And Jesus intervenes. So now, here in John chapter 21, they're going through all of this, and somehow, no doubt, John remembered. You know, I've been in this situation before, where we were fishing together and didn't catch anything, and I remember the Lord intervened. And so he intellectually put that together and concluded, it's the Lord, and told Peter, it's the Lord. And it's sort of registered with Peter as well. And so now they recognize this as being Jesus. And then Peter does something that is pretty remarkable. At verse, it continues, when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garments, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. So John said, it's the Lord. And Peter, right, we've done this before. We've gone through this before. And he immediately then wants to swim to Jesus. So he has stripped down. Some translations indicated that, you know, used the word naked. But he probably, no doubt he wasn't naked. He had his undergarment on. And a lot of times fishers it was a lot of work involved, and they would often strip down to just their undergarments as they were working and toiling and sweating and all of that. So he realizes that's Jesus over there, and he puts his garment back on, jumps in the water to swim to Jesus, which is that's in contrast to what happened in Luke 5. What did we just read in Luke 5? What did Peter want to do at in Luke chapter 5? Huh? He wanted away from Jesus. He felt just in awe of the whole situation and guilty, whatever it was, and he wanted Jesus to depart. This time, he wants to get to Jesus as quickly as he can. So again, a contrast there and a different mindset from Peter on these two occasions. But he puts that garment on and he swims to Jesus. Of course, this gives opportunity. And, you know, I've talked a lot here recently about this sort of thing, so we'll not belabor the point. But it is a point to be made. What do people usually do? If they're going to jump in the water just decide to do it. What do they usually do? They start, right. You start taking your clothes off, not putting them on. Why in the world did Peter put on his garment? That's exactly right. That respect. He was going to Jesus. So he put his garment on. And we can make a point, can't we? Again, here goes Don again talking about that. But the fact of the matter is, we forget. I mean, that's my whole point. And when we come together to worship God, we need to realize that we're before the greatest being, the supreme being. That's who we're worshiping. And even, of course, Jesus. Whenever we come to worship, we're in the presence of our King. And here we see Peter, without even thinking, I'm going to Jesus. I can't go to him like this. It matters what I look like when I go before Jesus. He puts his garment back on and then jumps in the water and swims to him. And there's at least a principle there that I sure wish we get back to. I've told you many times here lately that we're just going the wrong direction with regard to attire, just casual attire, when we're coming to worship, to pay homage to God. And now this is what I'm about to say, it's just my opinion. But I've told you that we are going the wrong direction with regard to that, and we're doing so very rapidly. And it's my opinion that it could, I'm not saying it's going to, but it's going to get to the point where we're so casual, where some people are going to start thinking in the other direction. They're going to realize, boy, that we're just way too almost like liberal brethren. Like with a lot of liberal practices today, people just love the social gospel and that sort of thing. But there are some places where they're going so far where some brethren think, maybe I can see now we're going down the wrong track. Like that's way out there. And that might happen with our attire. We get to the point where half the people are coming in shorts and flip-flops. There are going to be some people who will go to congregations that continue to do what they can to show that they understand the importance of the situation and say, I just visited a congregation and I kind of like that. And I'd like for us to be one of those congregations that people could look at and say, they haven't gone that direction to that extent, because it's happening everywhere. Everywhere I go, there are people wearing shorts and things to services. And it's just a few. But everyone's real casual, from the preacher to elders. In fact, I maintain the only reason why we're hanging on a little bit is because of our elders. And they're taking the lead and continuing to try to show respect as you come and worship God. If our elders were to come casual, it would open up the floodgates, I guarantee it. But I'm seeing more and more. And when I read this, it just kind of comes to my mind. That's interesting that Peter put his garment back on. Instead of just diving into the water and going to Jesus, he put his garment back on because he was swimming to his master. And that should say something to us. So anyway, all right, probably stayed on that a little bit too long. But something for us, and again, just as individuals to think about, each one of you as an individual, we all need to give some thought to how we appear before God when we worship him. All right, so it says, so the other disciples came in the boat. So Peter swims to the shore there, and the other disciples came in the boat dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. And when they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire in place and fish laid out on it in bread. Now, where in the world did that come from? Where did that come from? And again, there's nothing real definitive in this passage with regard to answering these kind of things. A lot of people believe, and I may be one of them, that Jesus provided here. that again, he shows up out of nowhere, it appears. And now all of a sudden they go out, fish all night, they come back, and there's a fire going and bread and fish. And there's something else in here that there's more to it than meets the eye. You don't really see it particularly in the English translation here, but it says, Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish that you have just caught. And Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore. So Peter was just kind of a take charge guy. He just did things. You know, he'd act quickly and sometimes too quickly. He was impetuous. We know that. But here he just goes. Jesus says, bring some of the fish, and Peter goes and he gets it. And, you know, it's heavy and they had to haul it. But Peter goes, and so Simon Peter goes aboard. He hauls the net ashore full of fish, 153 of them. It's just amazing. You read things and people come up with there's something behind everything. Like, what's the significance of 153 fish? Probably nothing. Probably absolutely nothing. But you know, one, I think it was Jerome back in the early centuries who talked about the naturalist who came along and said, well, there were at that time 153 different kinds of fish. And so the symbol behind that was that they were to be fishers of men and get men from every kingdom. Really? Boy, that would be nice and neat if that all fit together. But how in the world would you prove something like that? So probably 153 has no real significance to it. If there is, I'm missing it. But, you know, we don't want to get too carried away and read something into everything. Yeah, Greg, go ahead. Right. Yeah. Yeah, well, the one thing they knew, first of all, it doesn't only say 153 fish, 153 large fish. So one thing they knew, and I don't know that the number was exact, you know, maybe they can't. In fact, that has been suggested that they counted it because, you know, they wanted to keep track, whatever. One thing they knew, that was a big catch. That's the main thing. And not only that, not only was it a huge catch, 153 was a lot of fish to catch at one time when you throw a net over. So that's really the significance. But what happened to the net? It didn't break. This time, unlike Luke chapter 5, when it broke, this time it didn't break. And most would conclude that there was a miraculous element to that. And again, wouldn't be dogmatic about it. But generally speaking, 153 large fish would be too much for the net to hold without tearing. But this time, for whatever reason, the Holy Spirit finds it necessary to let us know it didn't tear. So all of this might point into the fact that some of these things that are happening are supernatural. And it says, and although there were so many, that it was not torn. And Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. I think some translations say, come and break your fast, which is sort of interesting. Is that where we got breakfast from? Come and break your fast. And now none of the disciples dare ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. And Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and so with the fish. Now here's the thing about that. Both the word in the Greek, the word bread and the word fish is singular, indicating that there was just one. That Jesus, just like he did earlier in the book, what was it, John chapter 6, multiplied the food form. And again, I'm no Greek scholar. I don't know about that. I know in John chapter 6, it doesn't just say bread, it says loaves. But It does, in some translations in John chapter 6, it will have fishes, plural. But here it just says fish. So, you know, none of this is to get bogged down on, but it could be that Jesus is doing some miraculous things here. And one of the things that's very important in all of this, that everything that Jesus did, remember when we get over to the book of Acts, that Jesus had told them that, or I guess Luke recorded it, that many infallible proofs he would appear to them for 40 days, and many infallible proofs would be done. And now perhaps we're seeing some of that with Jesus. He's not only appearing to them after his resurrection, but he's leaving no doubt whatsoever in their mind that he is who he says he is, that he is the Christ. And because, yeah, I mean, he wanted that firm in their mind. And that, well, that's what, when you look at verse 12, it's just the reading there is sort of interesting. I think it is at verse 12. Let's see. So Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. Yes. And now none of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? Well, that's sort of interesting. Why did it say that? None of them would dare ask, who are you? But then it turns right around and says, they knew it was the Lord. But when it says none of them would dare say, who are you? At first, you get the indication, was there any doubt in some of their mind? And collectively, they knew this is the Christ. But the things that Jesus are doing right now is removing, if there's any shred of doubt in any of their minds individually, he's doing all he can to remove every little trace of doubt in their mind. Why? Because when this is over, here shortly, he's going to ascend on high, and these men are going to be his ambassadors. Not going to be any room for doubt in their minds whatsoever. They have to be 100% sure of exactly who Jesus is, who the Messiah is, and that Christ is indeed that Messiah. That not just the one who is with them for these days, they know, again, this is the third time he's appeared to them. They know that. They know that this Lord, that this Jesus is the one who was leading them the last 3.5 years or so. But they have to be absolutely convinced he is the Lord. He is the anointed one. He's the long-awaited Messiah. Like after this, there can be no doubt in their mind. And so that ties in again to why it is that Luke stated he not only appeared to them, but gave them many infallible proofs for those 40 days. And some of these things that are happening in this chapter, some may wonder, well, was that really a miracle? Was that miraculous? Was that supernatural? Maybe a lot more going on than we thought. But a lot of these things, you know, Jesus, even when you stop and think about it now, Jesus is on the shore, just going back at the overall scene here. He's on the shore and tells them to cast the net into the sea on the other side of the boat. Did Jesus from 100 yards away see on the other side of their boat a school of fish and just give them a good tip? I mean, there had to be a miraculous element to that, didn't there? And it could be explained away. And again, I've read some commentaries that emphasize the fact, and this is true, that at some vantage point, as you stand on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, you could actually see a little bit better into the waters than those who were on the sea itself. And I have no doubt that there's truth to that. But 100 yards away, the sun, it's the break of day, it's still dim out, and Jesus could see a big school of fish that they couldn't see. There had to be a miraculous element to all of this. And all of that together, again, I'm convinced that John put all that together and said, you know, I remember this happening before. That's not just a stranger way over there on the shore. That's our Lord. Go ahead, Sam. Right. Yes. And who knows what you know, a lot of these things would trigger some of these experiences in the minds of the apostles. As they, they were just human beings, men just like we are. And so certainly some of these things that are happening would trigger some things in their mind. Remember that. And in fact, as we continue to read here, there's no doubt in my mind that this is the case with Peter as he begins to deal with Peter. Look down at verse 13. Jesus came and he took the bread and he gave it to them and so with the fish. This was now the third time that Jesus was revealed to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. All right, verse 15. And when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And so now Jesus is dealing with Peter specifically. And there is no question that this is tied into the fact that Peter is the one who denied him. And so he's going to leave no doubt, really. But that there, and I think perhaps he has even indicated this previously to Peter. I can't be sure about that. But that he's leaving no doubt that Peter's okay. I mean, he did a terrible thing. He denied Jesus. I mean, that could have ruined everything for Peter. And going forward, when Jesus goes away, there can't be this lingering doubt with one of the apostles. And so he's trying to, whether this is done, there's some indication that he kind of takes him aside here, at least at some point. I'm not quite sure exactly when, but at some point here, he's on the move with Peter. But I'm not sure if it's right here at the beginning or not. Some of it's vague and it's hard for us to know unless we were there and we're not. But at least in Peter's own mind, Peter had to be still have this on his mind. You know, hadn't been that long since he denied Christ and wept when Jesus made eye contact with him. You know, Emma, you know how we have self-doubt sometimes in our own mind? How am I going to lead? How am I going to be a leader here after I did that? So Jesus begins to question him. The first thing he asks him is, do you love me? Now, notice he says, Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Well, that again is kind of vague. More than these what? There are a lot of people who think, and I may have mentioned this last week when I talked about him going, you know, there's a group of commentaries that believe that Peter sort of, when he said, I'm going fishing, that he was kind of walking away from his spiritual responsibility there. And that same group then would take the these here to refer to the physical, to the boat and the net and the fish and all of that. And him basically, Jesus saying, do you love me more than this, your occupation? Remember, that was his livelihood. Do you love me more than your occupation? More than these physical things? And I don't believe that's what he's referring to here. But again, there's no question that if Jesus were to ask us that, we ought to be able to say, yes, Lord, I love you more than my occupation. I love you more than my car. I love you more than these physical things around. But probably the context, the other position would be that these is referring to the other apostles. Do you love me more than these? And that would fit more into the denial of Peter. Because what happened before he denied Jesus, what did Peter say he would never do? Huh? He would never forsake him. And do you remember what he said? Maybe they will. Or he didn't come out and say they will. But, you know, he indicated that maybe they would, but I won't. And that was indicating in his mind that he loved Jesus so supremely, more than the rest of them, more than the others, that Even if they forsook him, he wouldn't. A sense of superiority, perhaps, with that. But he definitely brought the other ones into the situation before he denied Christ. Oh, they might. I won't. Well, now Jesus here, he kind of wanted to see if Peter has grown any. Now Jesus brings them in. Do you love me more than these? Old Peter would have said, well, you know I love you the most, Jesus. You know I love you more than these. But on this occasion, Peter doesn't mention the other ones at all, does he? In fact, you may have studied this before, where Jesus here uses the word, when he says, do you love me? He uses the word agape. At least the verb form of it. But the word agape, which you know and I know, that's the highest kind of love. Peter, when he says, you know I love you, he uses the word phileo. Now, that's not that big of a deal. I think some commentaries have made too much of that. Like, there's a lot of people who think that this is painting Peter in a bad light. That this is why Jesus does this three times. Because he keeps saying, at least the first two times, Jesus says, do you agape me? Oh, Lord, you know I phileo you. And then he turns out again, Peter, do you agape me? And Peter says, you know I phileo you. And then in verse 17, the third time, Jesus says, Peter, do you phileo me? And Peter's grieved. Now, some, again, read into that. Like, Jesus was pressing Peter, do you love me with the highest degree of love? And Peter saying, Lord, I phileo you. And they make a big deal of that difference. I think if you really studied that, you would see in the book of John that those words are in some ways used interchangeably. And John used the word interchangeably. And I don't think at all that somehow Peter is, you know, I don't love you. I really don't agape you, Lord. But I do fillet you. Phileo you. I don't think that's the situation at all. It could be just a humbling thing that Peter didn't want to out loud say, I agape you. Like, you know, that it would kind of, if I asked you, do you love the Lord? And you said, oh yeah, I love the Lord with the greatest kind of love possible. I might think, well, that was kind of braggadocious, wasn't it? That, do you? Really? And yeah, I'm not about to say Peter didn't. But when he says, I phileo you, instead of that being really, this is kind of difficult to explain. You know, you've heard many sermons on the different kinds of love. And agape is the highest love, but only from the standpoint that it is the widest love. It's the broadest love. It comprehends more than anything else. As we've often said, it comprehends your enemies. So phileo isn't as broad, but it doesn't make it a weak word. In fact, phileo has more feeling to it. Phileo is the love that denotes attachment, strong friendship. And so Peter saying to Jesus, I phileo you, that isn't a sign of weakness or, oh, he doesn't love Jesus enough. No, he's really pouring out his heart. And confessing how attached he is to Jesus. And so I don't think at all, I wouldn't side with the group that thinks that somehow or another there's a big play on the words here. They are different words, but I'm personally not going to read too much into that. But before we close, because you guys sure have been gabbing a lot this today, so we'll finish this up next week for sure. But look at the last part, verse 15, the important part there. He says to him, "Feed my lambs." And now he's going to go ahead and repeat this three times. And really, the only difference in the instruction that he gives. He, at verse 15, he says, feed my lambs. And then at verse 16, he says, tend my sheep. And again, I don't read too much into that. He says, feed my lambs again at verse 17. Some people have said the difference between the lamb and the sheep is a matter of young and old. And he's saying at first, take care of the young members, and then later on, you tend to the more mature. You know, I'm not going to read all that into it. The fact of the matter is, Peter and the other apostles would have a job to do, and their job would have to do with people. It would be the Lord's people, and they would have to feed. They would have to tend to, watch over, and guide the people of the Lord. Of course, we know Peter actually became an elder, didn't he? So he would literally be an overseer in the Lord's church. But all of the apostles were to have that leadership role where they would have to watch over the people of God. And so the point of it is, Jesus basically is saying, all right, you say you love me, you're going to have to prove it by doing your job well, which would include primarily taking care of the sheep. And so we'll pick up there next week. He repeats that three times, and on the third time, Peter's kind of grieved that he did it again, said it again the third time. And we're not exactly told why, but we'll talk about that just a little bit. And then we'll conclude the book for sure on next week.